Hello. Are you busy right now? Cool. I didn't think so. So here's what you can do with some of your free time. Head over to podcastawards.com and nominate School Sucks Podcast for a 2010 Podcast Award. We would appreciate nominations in either the Best Produced or the Education category. And even though our listenership has increased dramatically since this time last year, and our following on Facebook has toppled since then, we definitely still need your support because the competition is tough. And right now, you might be saying to yourself, hey, is this that song from the movie Teen Wolf that was playing in the background during that final basketball game when Scott's team, the Beavers, had to go up against the most feared team in the entire league, the Dragons, in some kind of vague but obviously very important championship game? And Scott had to go head-to-head with that guy Nick, even though they were dramatically different in size. And there was previous tension between the two of them because Scott had had sex with Nick's girlfriend while he was a wolf, because apparently she was into that, and Scott chose to play the game as himself instead of as the Teen Wolf, which he had done most of the season, which really wasn't fair to the other teams or to the people on his team. But he mustered the courage to show up as his regular human self to prove to his dad and to Boot, and most importantly to himself, that he could help his team win the game without his special Teen Wolf basketball powers. Yes, it is that song, because it's not just a song about the underdog. It is a song about winning. Winning in the end. Because that's when winning counts. So head over to podcastawards.com and let's make something special happen together. And if all goes well, in the end, we could win one of these awards. Hey, that reminds me of a song. Yeah! Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Today is November 19th, 2010. Just a couple quick notes here before we get started. First of all, following what you just heard, if you've never seen the movie Teen Wolf, I'm sorry I just wasted 2.5 minutes of your life. But if you have never seen the movie Teen Wolf, please keep it that way. Do not see it. It is one of the worst movies ever made. It is just mind-bendingly awful. It was made in the 1980s. It's about a boy who turns into a wolf. It's anyway, the podcast nominations close on November 21st, so if you have not gone and nominated School Sucks Podcast for Best Produced and Education, and I learned you can nominate the show in both of those categories, so your support is greatly appreciated. I think you'll have to go back afterwards and vote for the nominees, assuming that we do get nominated. So I will definitely keep you posted on that. And if you've already done it, thank you so much. Today, a show I am really very, very excited about. I have three guests, Jan Ervin, Richard Grove, and Paul Verge, three friends, listeners of School Sucks Podcast, and media creators and collaborators on a project that I am very, very excited about promoting. It's a video series that is currently on YouTube. They have just released their pilot episode. The series is called What You've Been Missing. The first episode is called Exposing the Noble Lie. We are going to discuss today a historical survey of education and manipulation. And the research that these three guys have done is extraordinarily impressive. I will tell you, you are going to hear some words, some phrases, some topics of discussion that might make some people a little bit uncomfortable. If you are a listener to the Liberty Radio Network, you will realize that these guys are coming at things from a slightly different angle than you might be used to if you've been listening to shows like Free Talk Live or Free Domain or School Sucks Podcast or Complete Liberty. But what they have to say, the research that they've done, so, so valuable that I really hope these two networks, the Liberty Radio Network and their group, which is called Tragedy and Hope Communications, will really, really start to overlap. And you'll see what I mean, and you'll certainly, certainly see the value in what they are doing. And I just could not recommend enough this series that they have put together called What You've Been Missing, as well as checking out all of their other work as well. They're going to give their websites, their projects, a little bit of information about their background, and then you are going to hear for more than an hour this discussion that the four of us had that I just think was wonderful. Wonderful! And I should also point out that one of the people you're going to hear from today, Richard Grove, is really a particularly important figure in the development of this show, School Sucks Podcast. Richard hosted the first podcast that I ever listened to. I think I started listening maybe in 2006. The show was called 9/11 Synchronicity. And Richard was an insider, a whistleblower. He worked in the World Trade Center, and he noticed some very, very bizarre events, a lot of it related to insider trading in the days before, during, and after the events of September 11th. He certainly sacrificed quite a bit to do what he thought was right and to make sure that his story eventually got out for people to hear. His show that I listened to years ago, I really modeled the production style of School Sucks Podcast after his presentation. And I know there's certain people who might be saying, oh, 9/11. Well, and you know my feelings about the subject today and how much, energy and effort I think should be devoted to uncovering what happened there. Richard's work has just evolved so much, I think, since then, based on what I'm hearing now. And I mean, what he was doing then was excellent. And, you know, what he's doing now is just really so important. And it's such a nice compliment to what our goals are for School Sucks Podcast. And just on a side note here, it was a really nice feeling after having logged a number of hours listening to somebody else's work. And in Richard's case, he produced some pretty long podcasts. Some of the shows were like 6 or 7 hours long. After having put that time into somebody else's work, it was really neat when he actually contacted me, I think, for the first time 6 or 7 months ago, having heard School Sucks Podcast, and he expressed an interest in doing some collaboration in the future. And I just think that's great when you don't know somebody and you just kind of admire their work or their efforts from afar, when they reach out to you because they find value in something that you're doing. The same thing was true with Jason Osborne, who first contacted me, I think, in the fall of 2009. And he has helped the show out tremendously in the last year with funding for not only merchandising, but also spreading the awareness about the show through, you know, Free Talk Live advertising. And the same was also true with Stefan Molyneux, who contacted me around the same time just to do an interview and to kind of get a picture of what my goals were for this show. So, but that's life. It just kicks ass all day long. I wake up in the morning and I clap my hands and I say, this is going to be another great day. And then it is. And of course, today I value all three of those relationships far, far beyond just how do you feel about School Sucks Podcast and what can you do to help me? I think that obviously goes without saying. Just an interesting and meaningful side note for me there. So you will definitely hear more from Richard, from Jan, and from Paul in the future. And I promise, or I really believe, that after hearing this discussion that we have for the next hour, you will be excited about that future and you'll be excited to learn about and hear more from these three guys. I will leave it there for today.
For thousands of years, the few have used knowledge as power to control the many and profit from their ignorance. Over hundreds of generations, the masses have outsourced their thinking and unquestioningly consumed products of deception. Today, as a result, the non-elected rulers continue to persuade us to adopt their limited perspectives. This series resurrects your curiosity and broadens your awareness so you can learn how to read between the lies. This is What You've Been Missing.
The goal of this series is to provide you with the tools to understand the world in which we all live, so we can learn to survive and thrive in life. Greetings and welcome. I'm your host, Richard Grove. What you've been missing is an educational exploration designed to stimulate you and your potential, to resurrect your curiosity, and to inspire you to think critically so your decision-making and realization of enjoyment in life goes off the charts. Submitted for your approval, this is the episode pilot of What You've Been Missing, titled Exposing the Noble Lie. We've got a lot to catch up on, and here's why. Our research over the past 7 years has uncovered the following three facts. One, that the systematic form of critical thinking upon which the Western world was built was taken out of our education system in the 19th century. Two, as a consequence of our education system being censored, those of us born in the 20th century were easily shaped, conditioned, and manipulated by sophisticated forms of propaganda and public relations, leaving us in a world based on illusions of knowledge and not actually knowledge itself. And three, as a consequence of points one and two, those of us inhabiting the 21st century are faced with problems that seem to be unsolvable and pressures and responsibilities for which we are not educated to be successful at resolving.
3, 2, 1. I'm being joined today by Jan Ervin, Richard Grove, and Paul Verge, the co-creators and collaborators on What You've Been Missing, a project that I am very excited to chat about today. I'm going to let everyone go around and introduce themselves and discuss their individual projects. Jan, we'll start with you.
Sure. My name is Jan Ervin. I'm the I run GnosticMedia.com, which is a publishing company where I've published several books of my own, including one other. I also run the Gnostic Media podcast and TriviumEducation.com and various other projects that I've been working on, including video and other media for the last, 10 or 15, almost 20 years I've been an activist, but sort of media for about the last 10 years. And so, well, I guess that's about enough about me.
All right. Where you're out in California, where about?
I'm in Southern California, in the Southern California mountains, the rim of the world.
And Paul Verge, you are up in Vancouver?
That's correct, Vancouver, British Columbia, in the cold recesses of Canada. And I run Divergent Films, which is a modest film company that's produced a few documentaries, including Bursting Bubbles of Government Deception, Hijacking Humanity, and my collaborations with Rich, which include 2020 Hindsight. Yeah, and I've only been doing this for about 7 years, and my story is told in Hijacking Humanity, but essentially... Yeah, just working out of Vancouver. I also helped create a group called thinkfree.ca, which I run with my friend Robert Christie. And yeah, I've just been blessed to come across so many great activists and people that want to collaborate on projects that we all have common ground on. So,
and Richard Grove, you are in East Hartford, Connecticut.
That is correct. Yeah, we've lived in East Hartford for about 6 or 7 years now. And in talking with Jan one day, he suggested that I publicize my research, which was published by Maria Heller in 2006, called Project Constellation, is the name of that podcast. And from that, I created a full-length podcast called 9/11 Synchronicity, and then I started to produce films. And currently, we're producing TragedyandHope.com and the Peace Revolution podcast.
And what is TragedyandHope.com?
Well, Tragedy and Hope is a book which was written by Professor Carol Quigley in 1966, a book which had its plates destroyed and its publishing company was purchased up to suppress the book. And I didn't discover this until I was about age 30. So come upon a book that's older than I am, that holds all the keys to everyone who in the research community was asking these questions. Here's a guy who had taken 20 years out of his academic career to write a book which was called Tragedy and Hope. So we took that name and the notion that reading books can help renew our freedom if we properly understand what freedom is supposed to be in the first place. And we can't do that with the inadequate and incorrect map we've been given by our public education system.
Absolutely. So all of us come from different places, different backgrounds. We had certainly, very divergent experiences that led us up to this point, but we're all kind of pursuing similar goals today. So what I really wanted to focus on, in addition to the Trivium, was this project that you guys have created and will be continuing to work on in the future called What You've Been Missing. Does somebody want to give an introduction to what that is? Anyone?
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. What You've Been Missing is essentially the end result of us collaborating for several years in terms of trying to get a common focus and trying to find out what the root cause of what's going on in the world, instead of, you know, there's a lot of groups devoted to a lot of things, but we see that a lot of that's really hacking at the branches of the problem rather than the roots. Mm. And with What You've Been Missing, it's essentially not only supposed to identify the root of the problem, but also, and the root of the problem being the lack of critical thinking, or the use of this critical thinking system called the Trivium, and its persuasive rhetoric against the common population. It's allowing these elite sophists to control our minds through their sophist rhetoric. And the fact that we don't have the Trivium in our public education system means we're ripe for being manipulated through propaganda and advertising. And, making people understand that root cause and giving them back the Trivium, teaching them the fallacies and ways to improve and articulate their own speech, essentially is like the root way to fight back against this kind of ideology of force and aggression. Because without being able to communicate properly, you can't get other people to understand what's really going on and thus address the root problem. They'll just keep hacking at the branches. So What You've Been Missing is the result of all that common understanding shared in a video format that criticizes and complements media that illustrates what's going on.
Excellent. So, Jan, you've done a tremendous amount of research on the Trivium, and I'm sure Richard and Paul are right there with you in that respect. But in the series, it's mentioned that this Trivium, which is kind of often pulled together with a more classical form of education, was removed from education sometime during the 19th century. So what do you suggest were the motivations or the causes behind that removal?
Well, it appears that certain factions of elites in around the 1850s sought to take control of the population by subverting their intellect. And in what made the U.S. so strong at that period was these small local communities with these single room schoolhouses where you had young children being taught with teenagers all in one room. And the younger ones would learn what the older ones were being taught, and then the older ones would again turn around and help teach the younger ones, which would reinforce what they were learning. And back then, they had something, as you just said, the Trivium. It was a system that was taught to children and up into high school, basically. A systematic form of critical thinking, and the Trivium is grammar, logic, and rhetoric, specifically in that order. And by removing these things from the education system and putting in mandated education, over several decades, they were able to dumb down the masses that by the time of the 1910s and 20s, most of the people under the age of 40 or 50 no longer had it, and only the elderly had it by then. And then by the 1950s, they were saying that unless you were 90 years old, you didn't get this education.
So the thinking is that it was pretty standard that the education was a word. We talk a lot about language and the power and the weapon that language is and has been as we look at its usage in the media and in the schools with politicians and, of course, even in marketing and advertising, which people frequently overlook. Language is a very, very powerful weapon in its ability to control how people think. So the word education itself, you're right. Everybody who's been born any time during the late 19th or during the 20th century at all has come to understand education as a bunch of people who get shoved into a building and really not told or not taught or shown or guided through the process of learning how to think, but being very much directed through the process of being told what to think. That's pretty much it, right?
Right. You know, and yes, and I think looking back and looking at a lot of the books out there on the subject, like John Taylor Gatto, it looks like the single room schoolhouse was one of the largest threats to the elitists who wanted to maintain control and keep everyone in a state of serfdom, basically. And with the single room schoolhouse and that form of education, they just couldn't pull it off. It was people, by teaching and being taught and going through the ropes of grammar, logic, and rhetoric in those years, they couldn't be manipulated in that way.
Right, absolutely, which today we would all agree is just done with a tremendous amount of ease. And, you know, the other thing that I was interested in touching on here as well was, Richard, you've done years and years and years of very thorough and exhaustive and complete research on who these people are. It's something that I haven't really focused on too much on my show, is kind of connecting the dots. Like, I assume that was the intention behind the name Project Constellation, trying to look at how these different groups of people interact with each other, or know each other, where they come from, how they connect. And I think that being able to give people that kind of picture takes this away from just some kind of vague or nebulous conspiracy. And you can really see these connections, and you can really see how these people move together through time. So do you want to just touch on some of that research briefly here? Because I think it's a really important part of something that I've neglected, first of all, to do the amount of research that you've done, but also to include that in my show. I think some people might find that interesting and enlightening.
Well, I'd start off by drawing a metaphor. And you know, in ancient times, when people would sit out and look at the sky, I think they used to have arguments whether or not the heavens moved. And so because there's such a myriad of stars, countless stars, they began to try to make sense of them by connecting some of them together and using pictures and stories to help them understand. Now bring that up 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 years to our present time, and there was an artist in the early 21st century named Mark Lombardi, and he drew these giant murals that connected politicians, bankers, people who have these nefarious connections. He modeled the Vatican banking scandal, these sort of things. And through his art, you could see the corruption. You could see the connections of the corruption. Unfortunately, he died in a very suspicious way on March 22nd, 2000, shortly before his art was to be displayed at the Whitney Museum. But when you get a hold of his book, which has the art in it, produced by Judith Rothschild Foundation, you can see the connections between BCCI and Iran-Contra and the Bush family and the Bin Laden family, and see that all these people have been doing business. And so what you realize, and what I realized in a very harsh way on 9/11, was that my public education that I had gone through for approximately 15,000 hours was not nearly adequate to cover the reality in which I was trying to survive. And it was at that point when I decided to, you know, get out of the hamster wheel, stop using my energy to make other people millions and millions of dollars, and to start educating myself, because the money was worthless on 9/11. didn't matter how much money I had. I had no clue what was going on. And if I hadn't panicked and gotten myself out of that situation, I probably would have died that day.
Very. And you know, the other thing, too, when you look at the big picture and you see these connections and you learn about some of these people, I think a lot of people overlook the fact, again, through their programming that comes from language, using words like we and us and are to talk about the people who exercise all of this power over their lives. What is really missing from the picture when we try to look at, you know, the power structures that for so long people have lived under? We don't really get into the psychology of power. We don't realize, or people don't, maybe they don't even want to acknowledge that these types of people are fundamentally different from what we'll call ordinary folks. You know, like, I think that people run to the polls every chance they get to vote for, you know, their so-called representatives or the president of the United States. And you mentioned George Bush. People went and check boxes next to his name a couple of times. And they don't realize, the people who supported him, that he has so much more in common with somebody like Obama or Saddam Hussein, or, you know, name the world's worst tyrants and dictators, than he actually has with the people who are kind of following him along and cheering for him. And the same could be true for Obama or anybody else. They don't understand that is a different psychology, because they're kind of, through this collectivism and nationalism, they have these just invented connections with these kinds of people. But in many of these cases,
That's the PR and the education, though. When you look at a movie like Jesus Camp and you see a bunch of people being programmed through religion and then programmed sub-religion to support a particular political party, that's the trap we all fall for. And the reason we all created What You've Been Missing is to show that we've recognized our own incompetence and we're trying to learn our way past that. So it's all about everyone is participating, yourself included. We all recognize the inadequacy and the incompetence that we were bringing forward as a function of this public education system. And when you bring it into who supports these parties, if everyone was given full disclosure, nobody would be supporting these people. And it's only because of the subversion of our education system, which is a conditioning system, it's a conformity system, and the failure of the media and the failure for everyone who's consuming this media to think critically. Otherwise, they couldn't have control over us at all.
And, you know, I think that part of the control through the education system comes down to, we talk about the psychology of power, but it also how this whole system, this whole what's imposed on us through these, you know, 12 years. And for many of us, it certainly continues into a higher education and then into adulthood through the media for the rest of some people's lives or most people's lives. There's a phrase that's used in What You've Been Missing that I really liked and I wrote down. And, you know, maybe Paul, if you want to comment on this first, and then, Jan and Rich, if you want to throw in on this as well. Provisional self-esteem, because I think that's a very powerful and important idea when it comes to education. Or the, you know, faux education, the facsimile education, provisional self-esteem. Hmm.
Well, provisional self-esteem could also be, you know, interpreted as conditional self-esteem. It's essentially giving the power and the dynamic of your self-esteem away to some external source, and only through that external source's adulation or appreciation do you feel good about yourself. So instead of feeling good about yourself because of your own, you know, actions and your own achievements, you have to get the teacher or the authority has to approve. And basically what it does is put you in a submissive position to, you know, obey whoever's out there claiming to be an authority, right? It's just a completely mindset, essentially.
And I ask there, too, because, well, we're talking about this collective identity that people, you know, they gain through religion or they gain through politics. And then when things go their way, let's say politically, which is all just an illusion anyway, they feel some sense of accomplishment or pride in that. And as we were just talking about how people identify more with their political masters than, you know, ordinary people, obviously we have the whole divide and conquer thing going on there. That phrase, provisional self-esteem, certainly popped into my head, because a lot of people are not just taking, you know, self-esteem and self-satisfaction, they're taking, in many respects, their entire identity out of these very shallow collectivistic associations that they choose. Does anyone else want to jump
in? The reason it popped into your head is because it's one of Gatto's seven things he teaches in Dumbing Us Down. It's provisional self-esteem is one of them. It says that you're nothing without the teacher's approval. It says unless you're getting a gold star and getting an A+, that, you know, you have to beg for the teacher's approval all the time. You have to ask to go to the bathroom. You have to sacrifice all sorts of other human rights and be subservient to a system to which you are not a volunteer. And it is run by extortion and the mob, basically.
Mm.
I mean, so that's what I learned from Gatto and listening to the School Sucks podcast. So there you have it.
So this trap of basically making people, I mean, what we're really talking about here is making people not just intellectual dependence, but basically psychological, emotional dependence on this system and this structure. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're trying to set up a dynamic where it's going to be a nanny state of mind, where we're not making any of our own decisions. We're like, you know, android meat sacks that are basically waiting to have programming put into us and to, you know, get all our instructions from TV, which turns whatever room it's in into a virtual Skinner box. And all we'll be responding to is this operant conditioning where, you know, the society or the system holds out these rewards and we base all our needs and desires on these rewards instead of what might actually be fulfilling to our true selves. And so then we're accumulating all this material wealth and still feeling empty inside because it's external ideas. It's like the movie Inception, right? Somebody trying to implant an external idea into your mind and it just won't take hold because it didn't come through you. You know what I mean? The mind rejects things that are external inherently. And so that's why the elites have to spend billions of dollars constantly rethrowing the propaganda, as George W. Bush would say, you know, constantly catapulting the propaganda, because it takes hold, but just like throwing, you know, fecal matter against the wall, it slides down eventually and they have to keep throwing more and more to make it stick.
Yeah, I like that analogy. And let's go back to a phrase you used a minute ago, the Skinner box, because when we start discussing what that is and where that comes from, it also gives us some context about what the thinking is behind some of these control systems that we deal with. So who wants to go on the Skinner box?
Rich, I think you ought to take that one.
Right on. I can handle the Skinner box. Operant conditioning was developed by B.F. Skinner, who was a Harvard psychologist in the 50s and really got into play in the 60s through advertising. So all of us have grown up most of our lives inundated through television advertising, radio advertising, advertising on our cereal boxes, all these sorts of things. And basically what they discovered, and we show a great deal of this in What You've Been Missing Episode 1, because the point is, once you recognize that the televisions in your classrooms are not your friend, the television in your house is not your friend, until you learn how to use it responsibly by critically thinking about what you're consuming, then you can use it as a tool to learn with. But until then, it's basically like, you know, the average child before like age 12 sees 14,000 murders that are committed in the safety and sanctity of his house, someplace where you're supposed to be protected from these types of images, because it's not as prevalent as what they show you on TV. They can take a very small situation, aggrandize it, and because you see it on every channel and read it in every newspaper, you think the whole world must be like that. And that's something that came into play in the early 19th century, the early 20th century, when they started buying off the newspapers and buying off these different media outlets to propagandize you with what they want you to react. And the problem is, it's all set up such that if you start critically thinking for yourself, then you can outwit these people who are trying to use operant conditioning and advanced psychological techniques to game you. You can stop being played by the game. You can learn the rules of the game, and you can make their game and make their model of controlling you obsolete. But it takes critical thinking, and it takes you wanting to invest in your own wisdom, because no one's ever going to give it to you. So it does take a little bit of work. But I would characterize more of what we've learned to do is live and think a certain way, which turns on critical thinking throughout your day. So it's not such a hard thing that you have to go and sit and study or do this thing. It basically is a systematic process that you just run in the back of your mind, and you're critically thinking before you're checking information in as knowledge. You're critically thinking about this, what you're seeing on TV, and you're eradicating all the contradictions. So what you're left with is the systematic form of certainty, which is what everyone in this place is denied, specifically because of the undermining of our school system, which should be this is something that everyone should be learning. So you have to ask the question why none of us are being taught about it, except through the work that we're doing together as independent media, which is why we're doing it. It's necessary.
Absolutely. And, you know, in addition to this sponge-mindedness effect that you're talking about, the media images, what the media presents, and also what we get throughout our entire public school experience is a very, very skewed view of humanity. You know, it starts in school where we learn this, we have this subject called history, which the way it's taught in school is really just a big long story about a bunch of violent sociopaths who are, you know, preying on and murdering people. And sometimes they're villains because they're on another plot of land, and sometimes they're heroic because what they did happened on this plot of land. So
I find it has a lot to do with the coordination of colors in their costume. For instance, red, white, and blue can represent France, Great Britain, or United States. And through history, it's just certain combinations
or Russia,
of colors that are
or
bad.
Serbia.
Right? I mean, just think about how funny it is, Brett. I mean, the different costumes and different flags under which all these people are fighting, all to serve the same masters who are creating their commerce system and creating their government systems and these ideas of statism in the first place.
Yeah, and I think that when we – that's the picture that we get of what's out there in the world and what's happened in the world, just this big, long, you know, thousands of years of violence and predation, it leaves people with a very skewed view of what humanity is. They leave this educational experience feeling that people are violent and dangerous and need to be controlled because look at what they did, not realizing that the people that they're looking at through their history education or, you know, mock education were the masters. So then we go to the television, to the mainstream media, and we watch the so-called news where there's all of this violence and murder. And it's really, it's just saying, here's all the newsworthy things that happened today, right? Like, it's not normal for people to kill each other. It's not normal for ordinary people to rob and threaten each other. So those things become newsworthy, but it makes it look as if the whole world is like that, and it just reinforces what we've learned before about danger and violence and constant threat, you know,
right.
Not realizing. Go ahead, Jan.
Right. Well, you know, what they're doing is they're taking the events that happen over an area that includes, like in California, that includes probably 15, 20 million people, right? And you put, you know, these events and that many people, and maybe there's one a day or one a week or something like that here and there in these various areas. But you put those on the media every day and you program that out to everyone, then it seems like it's a constant epidemic everywhere. But when you think about it in terms of percentages, you know, you have these things happening out of 20 million people, then the chance of it happening becomes rather insignificant.
You might get attacked by terrorists. I mean, there's like a nil percentage chance for the 300 million Americans to experience that, right? But there's 100% chance that you will get screwed by your education system.
Absolutely.
So that's the stats. What should you really be worried about? They get us to misprioritize our concerns by using emotional rhetoric, which could easily be, you know, you could easily insulate yourself from this if you use the tools of critical thinking in a systematic fashion, because that's how they're doing it to us so consistently.
And that's how we can learn to sort of start to bat away these emotionally laden words that are just – I've always said that if you want to prevent somebody from thinking about something critically, if you want to prevent somebody from thinking about something in a logical way, you get them to think about it emotionally. It's a trick that's worked beautifully when it comes to discussion about religion or politics. People have these emotional investments.
Let me jump right in there. In fact, I remember when I was a kid and a teenager growing up, whenever – the subject of politics or religion came up, my dad would always say right off the bat, "Oh, you never talk about religion or politics. Those are two subjects you never talk about." And when I look back at that, you know, I always thought that that was rather odd. And looking back, it's because if you talk about it, you might just figure out what was going on.
Exactly. Exactly. People, if people were comfortable having a 5-minute conversation about some of these things, that might lead to them calling shenanigans on a lot of this stuff.
Right. And all of the, you would have all of this other exterior input coming in because you wouldn't be afraid to talk about it. Oh, you know, and this is the same exact rule that's used in the workplace. You don't talk about politics and religion at work. And you don't talk about that at family dinners and stuff like that. Oh, you never talk about politics and religion at the dinner table. I used to hear comments like that all the time growing up. And looking back, it's kind of funny because in my particular instance, the people who would say those things looking back tended to not really have much understanding of what was going on.
Well, they didn't want their paradigm challenged, right? That's why you'll often find people either have an emotional investment and vigorously defend their status quo position, because to challenge it would require a bunch of effort of their thinking, right? The other side to that coin, though, is people who are so apathetic that they don't even care. They're just, their eyes glaze over when you start to mention anything about politics or religion or just the state of authority today. And it's because they've gone through, you know, that 12 years of conditioning and taken in all this propaganda and advertising.
Well, I think
stomps out your curiosity.
Well, the deeper issue, Paul, is that what happens is these people are actually raised to believe that these things don't affect them directly.
I think that's true, and I think we also, when people haven't or are not at the point where they're just so apathetic that they don't even want to engage in a conversation, you can see this. And these are people who are smart. I mean, we were told not to talk about these things in polite company a couple of years ago. I started trying it out. It hasn't gone exceptionally well, and I'm in the process now of, you know, rethinking some of my approaches, because I've realized that, gosh, it's probably not a problem with the message itself. Obviously we're also dealing with all kinds of, you know, cognitive dissonance and emotional obstacles with other people, but the presentation, I think, certainly could be refined. But it's frustrating to watch people who are, you know, they have this innate brilliance, this genius. They are in so many respects in their own lives so smart and talented, but when these conversations happen, we see this fight or flight response where they either steer around whatever the issue of discussion is to attack you on a personal level, or they literally sometimes run away or walk away, or they will try to retreat into this safety zone of, well, everyone's entitled to their opinion, let's change the subject, kind of a thing. So that fight or flight response is really indicative of an absence of an ability to think logically or critically about whatever the topic is.
And they're not seeing the third option. They're looking at you as a threat and having that response. But the third option is a form of nonviolent communication where you're not communicating to them in a sermon or confrontational mode where you're talking down to them or telling them what to think. Instead, you offer your assessment of the situation and you get them to try and agree with you, which puts them back into a positive wavelength, right? It's so much about the trivium in terms of grammar, logic, and rhetoric is not just taking in and understanding information and giving it back out. It is the actual understanding tonality, understanding how your language, the order of the words, the tone of the words, even the subject matter, the way you approach somebody, it completely affects how someone's going to respond to you. And we're not conscious enough of that because we hear sound bites on TV and we emulate what we watch, which is this very, very, you know, you can watch and see, you know, internet speak where people are like LOL and all this stuff. That's becoming the new norm for kids. right, as like a new societal slang, but it's a degeneration of language, right? Mm.
And that you mentioned nonviolent communication, where I think a lot of people, coming from my point of view, are starting to realize the value of this. And I've actually withdrawn from these engagements that always lead to, you know, anger or argument at the very least, to see if I can, like I said, refine my approach a little bit through understanding and learning about this nonviolent communication strategy. I think that's incredibly valuable. I think that in the past, we've done a lot of moralizing. I know I have anyway, when we've talked about things like the principle of non-aggression and using words like immoral. And boy, that is loaded up for a lot of people emotionally, to be told that something that they're supporting is immoral. And I think one of the reasons why that approach has developed, the argument from morality, as Stefan Molyneux called it years ago, is because that's always worked throughout history, right? Well, like getting people to do, like, good is the engine, good is the chauffeur, good is the gasoline that takes evil where it needs to go. So you make these presentations to people. Now in school, it's nationalism and patriotism, and everybody put their shoulder to the wheel, and we're a community, not ever paying any attention to what they're serving or what the goals are down the road or who's making those goals. And of course, it worked beautifully in religion for thousands of years, these moral arguments. So I think that historically, there's a value to it. I mean, just empirically speaking, it has worked for thousands of years for the worst kinds of people with the most dangerous ideas. Maybe it would work for some nice folks like us who have some, I think, some pretty decent ideas.
I think the real issue comes in that how these arguments are effective is the people that they're effective on don't have critical thinking to begin with. And we can focus on all of these different problematic areas and still not get down to the root issue.
Jan, when you say that, would you say it as they don't have explicit critical thinking? Because I think a lot of us thought we had critical thinking, and we did have an implicit form of critical thinking.
Right.
What you're talking about is a systematic, explicit form which they use.
There's implicit and explicit forms of critical thinking, and implicit is basically you have some capability of critical thinking, but it's not any type of systematic method. You can just recognize and deduce certain things logically, but deductive and having a systematic form of critical thinking is a completely different method, where you're analyzing all of the information coming in via the five senses to specifically determine what is coming in and removing any contradictions from there. Once you've gotten to a point of knowledge of what's there, you go to understanding, which is removing any contradiction. And then if you want to express it, and this is the grammar part, is actually the who, what, where, and when of a subject. And logic is the why of a subject. And then before you go and express what happened or what took place or what you figured out, the how of a subject, you've done these prior steps. And then being effective in your presentation, the rhetoric part, gets it across to other people eloquently without any of the other contradictions or anything else in there, systematically and concisely, so that they can understand it. And so it's not having this system in the first place that precedes everything else. You know, literally, the trivium method can be applied to every other topic, because not only does grammar deal with special grammar, which is words and language like English or Russian or Latin or something like that, but general grammar deals with any and all subjects that are out there, basically. The house, the car, the, you know, objects and things out in nature can be a part of general grammar, so, and mathematics and all of these things.
I think that might be a little, that might be in over a little bit of people's heads, dude. That's getting a little deep. Let's go back to using a metaphor so people can start to understand, because there's value in what you're saying, but I want to make sure there's a nice ramp so that people can get up to that step. So to use a metaphor, Brett, let's pretend that you have a PC. And on this PC, you'd be trying to transact data incoming and outgoing with the world, right? Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that you would have some sort of virus scanner and some sort of spam filter, because it's already known to you that by spending a couple $1,000s on a PC, it can be completely ruined by some incoming unknown that you don't know how to deal with. So people every day have these computers, and the computer is basically a hard drive, is like some rust on a disk, and the chips are made out of sand. And they're thousands of dollars, and we protect them with hundreds of dollars of software. But we have our minds, which are necessary to run these computers and to achieve satisfaction. And we don't protect our minds in the same systematic, simple way where you protect your computer. So you don't just check some downloads or some emails. You apply this filter, or these filters, these applications of software, these ideas, to everything that's coming in. And you also want to check outgoing, because you don't want to spread viruses or untruths or pseudo-truths to your friends and family. So using the metaphor of the computer and comparing it to your mind and the virus scanning software, spam software, and that's akin to this systematic form of critical thinking. Before you store it on your hard drive, i.e. your memory, you want to process it and make sure it's something that you want to allow and make storage for, because your mind is a precious place and you need to learn how to protect it, because everything in this world is built around exploiting the fact that some people know how you work better than you do. And that's a responsibility of self, to be autonomous.
Indeed. And we are going to cover, I know that we touched on the trivium briefly today. Obviously, this is going to be a whole series on this show. I certainly hope that all three of you will be participants in that. So we really can get into it in detail, and we really can provide people some guidance as far as how to implement this, and how to understand it, and how to navigate through it. And it's really amazing how, you know, simple, when we look at approaches to learning and structures for building and assembling and comparing and contrasting ideas, it's amazing how this became absent. It's almost like a miracle that this was removed completely from what people called education. So in the future, I really do look forward to getting into this in great detail with hopefully all three of you.
Likewise,
Brett.
Does
that mean you're kicking us off now, dude?
No, I have more time. I can go another 15, 20 minutes for sure if there's other stuff that you guys want to cover, especially related to what you've been missing. How are you doing on YouTube? Last time I saw it looked like it was around 20,000.
Yeah, I think we're at like 22,000 for the first video, and for all the videos combined, it's somewhere around just over 100,000. But that's, you know, essentially about 3,000 people have watched the full thing, at least on YouTube, and I'm sure at least double those numbers for Blip and some other sources. But it's getting around there. I'm gonna do another volley of postings and stuff to generate some more traffic. But the new episode will be coming out in a couple weeks, as far as I know. And that combined with, like, I'll also mention what you've been missing in Believers Beware. So there'll be a whole bunch of just stuff coming from all of us in the next few weeks and before Christmas.
Yeah,
look out for the stuff.
Brett, Jan, Enrich, all of you guys are like the main focus in the new Contrary Conditioning Believers Beware film. So
that's a documentary that you've done, Paul, that I was interviewed for. When is that going to come out, you think?
I'm just integrating these final interview that I did with Jan actually a few weeks back into the film, and that'll be out before Christmas, probably even in the next few weeks. It'll start to appear online, and it's actually like a 4-hour almost mini series, but in split into two halves. So what the first half focuses on the ideology and the philosophy and the deception of this quote unquote new world order, and the kind of sophist elites, and identifying the philosophy. And then the second half identifies specifically public education and Gatto's work and talks about the trivium and the quadrivium. So it's like identifying the problem and then hopefully offering part of the solution.
And you're saying that this kind of parallels, in some respects, the second installment of What You've Been Missing. Is that correct?
Yeah, it'll definitely be complementary because we're covering a lot of the same subject matter. It's just with my films, there's a lot more interview, like original interview footage with people. And with What You've Been Missing, it's more like taking clips of media and then offering our commentary or juxtaposing clips together to show an ironic truth or something, right? So it's kind of like two slightly different approaches to the same subject matter. And, you know, different people respond to different approaches differently. So hopefully we're covering more bases and then more people respond positively to all the work combined.
Excellent. So what's for the series, What You've Been Missing, do you guys want to talk a little bit about what you're thinking as far as the duration of the project or the number of episodes? I mean, it's a YouTube video, and of course, most of us are limited by YouTube to do. It's a film. I mean, it really is just the production of this is incredible, and I really suggest that everyone who is listening to School Sucks go and check out What You've Been Missing in 10 parts on YouTube. We're all limited to these, you know, 10-minute clips on YouTube, but it's roughly what? It's like 105, 110 minutes, the whole thing?
It's a two-hour double episode, the pilot episode. So in the future, it'll usually be an hour, hour and 15 minutes. The cool thing is we're not really limited by overall time, and we've got all the parts loaded up on Blip TV where you can watch longer segments in the future, at least, because the first time I cut it for YouTube, not thinking that I could upload the whole thing to Blip TV. But the point is that through the myriad of media that we've kind of produced over the years, Paul's films, Jan's podcast, my podcast, the group site, Tragedy and Hope, the group podcast being Peace Revolution, just giving people all these different ways to access it in, because we're all looking at different aspects of the same problem. And it's about time that we started saying, look, let's put our pieces together and see how this puzzle all, you know, what the big picture is. Because when you get into it from, you know, Paul's movie shows all the credible evidence of the New World Order from the elites, you know, the aristocracy's perspective in their own words. These are their plans, right? When you take these ideas that might sound like conspiracy theory, if you listen to media networks owned by the New World Order, and you start to look at the actual evidence, you start to discover that this subversion of our education system has basically been the same thing that's gone on with this New World Order idea. It's a group of elites. It's a group of aristocrats who got together in a club in Bavaria, first called the Perfectibilists, right? Mm-hmm. So they had this weird name, and they get together, and at the end of the day, it's founded by a professor at a university called Adam Weishaupt. And from there, they create a plan to subvert, starting with educations, because if you can control people's educations, you can control them. And if you can control educations, you can then control the diplomats and statesmen and therefore control war. And these are people who already controlled the monetary system. So they set a plan in motion, and the Skull and Bones gets installed, which is a German secret society installed at a university in 1832 at Yale. And some of the most powerful statesmen and Supreme Court justices and presidents of the United States have all come through this small club that only admits 15 members per year. Skull and Bones, when you follow that through Professor Anthony Sutton's work, for instance, from Stanford University, Sutton clearly shows that several key members of this small elite university group then had a very, very corrosive effect on the American education system, specifically taking out the tools that we need to first learn for ourselves, you know, to learn anything, and then the systematic approach to protect ourselves from deception. And Demosthenes, who died in 322 BC, was a famous orator who, part of him being famous was that he would be hired to write a speech for one side, then he would go to the other side and sell the speech, and then be hired to write a speech for that side and go back and sell it to the first side. And Skull and Bones basically took this on as their credo, because they've learned to profit from both sides. They Democrat, Republican, it does not matter. It's these groups are still achieving their agendas. And the thing that's important is, even though some of these groups do not exist anymore in the flesh, what they put into action, what they started funding, is very much still in action today, including the Rhodes Trust and the legacy of Cecil Rhodes through the De Beers monopoly. Through, you know, and all of our families are pretty much supporting that unwittingly, thinking that a diamond is a girl's best friend.
but I digress.
And it's a good point that you make too, because really in our circle here in New Hampshire, in our media group, which we usually just sum up as the Liberty Radio Network, and all of these shows, it's kind of become this unwritten rule. And I'm really glad too now that these circles are starting to overlap, and hopefully they will continue to do that. But we have this sort of unwritten rule. It's like that phrase that you don't say, because people are, I think, myself included, somewhat apprehensive about presenting to people as conspiratorial by using the phrase New World Order, and we shy away from that a lot. And I think that people, there's a lot of tension within this community over 9/11. And it's not like anybody is saying, no, the government wouldn't kill 3,000 people for some political agenda, because we all know that that is, I mean, all you have to do is look at Iraq. And But
that's a perfect example of putting the rhetoric before setting out the grammar and mm-hmm. establishing the understanding. For instance, if I use the term New World Order in an open conversation, I would refer to H.G. Wells' book from 1939 titled The New World Order and the ideas that are coming from this group of Fabian socialists, which are the Rhodes Roundtable people. So it's important to establish these pieces of evidence. For instance, the Illuminati, there's a great book from 1789 by John Robison, who is a world-famous physicist in England, who wrote and established all this evidence about the Illuminati. George Washington then read this book the same year. And if you go to George Washington's personal letters at the University of Virginia, October 24th, 1798, there's a letter from the Reverend George Washington Snyder to ex-President George Washington. And George Washington says, I'm very aware of the Illuminati and how they've infiltrated Freemasonic lodges and their pernicious principles, et cetera, et cetera. So once you establish the evidence, and people can see that is the fact, that is national history. Why aren't you taught this, by the way? Right? Then you can talk about these things without fear. I don't fear anyone taking a shortcut to thinking and cutting off their own potential by not listening to my words. That's not my responsibility. My responsibility is when I speak words, you can look them up and either agree with them or disagree with the evidence that I'm interpreting. But those are the words of the first president of the United States. So I haven't found anyone who effectively says, well, that those don't exist, or that's not credible evidence. That is credible fact in the world in which we live right now, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, and you're absolutely making the point for me that I was going to make here, too, because I'm saying that people shy away from these things. But I think if people want to understand or want to take a closer look, because we understand that a lot of these words and terms in this language is very vague and it's very kind of intimidating to people. But if people are curious and they want to be able to answer those incredulous questions that people ask, like, who is this group they? Who is the they? You know, you have put together something that really can, like, the fact that you have, made this connection between Robeson's book and Washington's letters is extraordinary research. And you know, a tremendous amount of diligence on your part. So I think that if people want to see, if people are curious about some of these networks that have gone in the shadows, because, I mean, the truth is we're all talking about it. We're just not using that name. We're all talking about the same thing. We all understand that this stuff is real. It's just like I recommend that if people want to become more knowledgeable and not just talking about things in these completely nebulous ways, that they go and they take a look at what you've been doing for the last 4 or 5 years. And then maybe if they do have to deal with that incredulity or those sort of, those questions where people are almost making light of what you're saying, they have some... They have quite a bit of ammunition, for lack of a better word, and evidence to back up a lot of these claims. So I think that that's really important. And what's interesting for me here is that it is something different. It is a different angle, a different approach from the one that we've been using. And when I say we, I'm talking about my show, a show like Complete Liberty, a show like Free Talk Live or Free Domain Radio that are all, existing in this this network of media. Some people are relatively even antagonistic against some of this stuff. And like I said, I've shied away from it a lot myself. But if people are curious You know, I could not all three of you guys, the work you've done, really highly recommended.
Thank you.
I'd like to also recommend the work of some of our other partners, because Jan and Paul and I all listen to your podcast, Brett. We listen to the Corbett Report and Media Monarchy, and it's through like learning from each other that we're not only like learning, but we're also growing and being inspired to create new things, new ways, and covering it from such a multitudinal perspective. We're kind of getting a comprehensive education and seeing how everything fits together, not just through one person's perspective, but through a bunch of people who are using a systematic form of critical thinking, creative problem solving, and communication to help kind of weed out the fallacies amongst ourselves and our own beliefs before trying to present it to an audience.
And we all have our parts to play. We all have our competencies too. Where, you know, I mean, I've dealt so many times with the question, I know you guys have heard me mention this before, when I'm critical of the government education system, people snap to this response of saying, oh, well, then design me an education system that will work for everybody if you're so smart. And that's not my job. That's not my goal. I don't figure out how sewage and roads work without violence in the future, right? Like, my job is to spread information based on what, you know, my experience, my knowledge, and my skill set is. So all of us are kind of like, what you're doing and what all of us are really doing is we're bringing these pieces together. I really like the puzzle analogy that you used, because we all have these areas that there's things that we are, you know, places where we're knowledgeable, places where we're not, places where we can help each other. And certainly, you know, there are thousands and thousands of people who are ready to get involved in doing the same thing, you know, once they figure out a role that they can play. So I, in the past, have been very dismissive of talking about anything that goes under this huge umbrella term a conspiracy. And I even did a show called Problem Reaction Solution, where I was kind of hostile towards some of this. But really, my point was, that's not my that's not my place. That's not what I'm doing. And it was a response to people who were, in many cases, suspicious of me for not addressing some of these things. So, but that just wasn't my area of expertise. And I know that there's people who are interested, and they want the contextual knowledge that goes behind all of this stuff, or on top of all this stuff, however you want to picture it. And because of that, I really appreciate what you guys have done and are doing and will continue to do.
Thank you.
Just make a comment.
Sure.
I was just going to say, in regards to why people tend to extend a taboo over the whole idea of New World Order and Illuminati and all that stuff, is because there's a lot of people who don't have adequate critical thinking who are latching onto those ideas. They emotionally sense something wrong with the world. And what it happens is a poisoning of the well, and kind of a guilt of it by association fallacy, where the term conspiracy has now been attached to the word theory, as if there's no such thing as a real conspiracy, you know, two guys getting together and plotting to defraud another group to make money. And so conspiracies are very real. They exist in law and everything. So by taking the grammar of the word conspiracy and attaching it to theory, they make it seem like every conspiracy must be just some theory, someone's idea of how events went down that is somehow in opposition to the official version of events, which is somehow always true. And because people take Illuminati or New World Order and make it into a group who's attached to space aliens or lizard people and all this stuff, and they take it to ridiculous proportions, it ends up people with credible evidence, you know, kind of get drowned out by the shouting of the people who get labeled as the quote-unquote conspiracy nuts.
Well, it's
so what we're trying to do with what you've been missing is communicate in a rational, calm way, which desensationalizes things to show that it's not about theories, it's about what we can prove factually. And you we're not going to tell you that there's conspiracies. You will realize that these conspiracies exist yourself.
Right. Go ahead.
And you know, it's like the very words liberal and trivium themselves, because the word liberal, actually, if you look up in any good dictionary, the word liberal means of or befitting the free, and it comes from the word liber, which is also Latin for book, and where we get words like library and liberty and any liber word, basically. But we're not told by the corporate media, who is seeking to subvert our freedoms, that liberal is the antithesis of what they're calling it. And in fact, antonyms for liberal, which is kind of funny when we get into these, but antonyms are uneducated, unintellectual, closed of heart, selfish, narrow, contracted, mean, small, fascist, racist, bigoted, homophobic, stingy, close-minded, supportive of monarchies and slavery, against freedom of religious expression and speech, and low in birth and mind, and of course, in a free country, it's anti-American. And the word trivium itself, and the reason why they've done this to the word liberal, let me step back a second, is because the word liberal is directly related to the seven liberal arts. The seven liberal arts are composed of the trivium and the quadrivium. The trivium is grammar, logic, and rhetoric in that order. The quadrivium is math, geometry, music, and astronomy in that order. And when you have all seven of those, that is the liberal education or the classical education. So they've twisted the word so that people don't realize that the word liberal itself is the key to personal and individual freedom. They have to suppress the word liberal to keep people from making that connection. And then the other word, like I was going into a second ago, is the word trivium. They've trivialized the word trivium, and they've made it trivious so that people, whenever they hear the word trivium, they go, oh, that's trivial, that's trivia, I don't need to learn that, that's been debunked, it's 2,000 years old, what could I possibly have to benefit by looking at that? And these are tactics that they've intentionally put into place to keep people from realizing that freedom is found in the books.
Yeah, we should also point out, too, that obviously being able to read is one thing, and for centuries and centuries, people were pretty much controlled by keeping them illiterate. It certainly worked
right.
For
literacy,
slavery.
Literacy is a form of slavery until critical thinking is exercised by the reader. And I think that the point is that the whole world is set up using words in law to control us. And Paul's done a great deal of study into decrypting how we're all controlled through straw men and corporations and all this other stuff that we've basically given our rights away because we haven't used our literacy to figure out the game that we've all been, you know, unwittingly sponsored into here. But we're in it and we need to figure out how it works. And it starts with, you know, considering the words that we're using and the contracts that we're obligating ourselves with and these sort of ideas.
Yeah, and I think I've made this, I've certainly said it many times in the past that centuries ago it was the divide between literacy and illiteracy, and today it's the divide between information literacy and information illiteracy. But I guess that's really always been
true.
Yeah,
which you can define as critical thinking versus not critically thinking, or as Erica
exactly.
Goldson put it, is not critically thinking thinking at all.
Right. Exactly, exactly. And that's what I think is really important. Just being literate, we see plenty of people who can read. You know what I mean? And obviously, it's a little bit more complicated than that. So we've touched on this information literacy thing several times, pretty frequently on my show in the past. And in the future, we're really going to get into this trivium and how it works and how, like I said, people can implement it. So does everyone – do we want to do some closing thoughts here? We can go right around and everybody can plug.
I would like to just first recommend a future guest for the School Sucks podcast. And it will be an ex-school teacher whose work we've all consumed, except for you maybe, Brett. Her name is Charlotte Iserby. And her father was a member of Skull and Bones, and she was a high-ranking member in the Reagan Educational Department. And she's a whistleblower, And her book, which is about 700 pages, you can get free online and get the PDF and read it before the interview even goes on. But the point is, if you want to make the factual and actual connections, I've seen presentations where Charlotte Iserby pulls out the books from 1798 and shows you first edition copies of what we were alluding to earlier today, which are the artifacts and evidence which substantiate that for a long time, longer than any of us care to think, we have been controlled by people who have a higher intellectual perception and comprehensive education. And unless we do that for ourselves, we don't have a chance of really being free.
Yeah, that's a good mention there, too, because I basically had forgotten about her. You know, there were, 4 years ago when I was formulating a lot of these ideas that were at the time, you know, I admit, very, very underdeveloped. I was trying to put all of this School Sucks together as a treatment for a documentary film, and I was using some of her work that I found online for that purpose. So that's definitely a good suggestion for the future. And she was somebody that I would say I was familiar with in the past, and then she just kind of dropped off the map. So I will definitely take another look.
You know, I was in contact with her recently and attempted to get an interview, but was unsuccessful. So maybe she would appreciate your work a little bit more because your podcast is called School Sucks, and you may be able to just get her on. So I'll be happy to rebroadcast that interview if you get that on mine as well.
Absolutely. And yeah, School Sucks does bother some people too, but I think, yeah, if she understands the intention, I will definitely give that a try.
Well, I think the word Gnostic, as in Gnostic media, had her a bit worried from the get-go.
Yeah, I could see that as well. Well, what's her? Does she have a
Catholic?
Oh, that will do it. So why don't we go around and everybody just make sure you mention your website one more time, and then we can close on what you've been missing here. So, Jan, go ahead.
Gnostic Media Podcast. You can get that at GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com. And I've also written a couple of books. Astrotheology and Shamanism was my first book, a couple others up there. And I also run TriviumEducation.com. And those are the two main websites that I've been working with as of late, as well as working with Rich and Paul on Tragedy and Hope and the What You've Been Missing series.
All right, excellent. And Paul?
I have divergentfilms.com and hijackinghumanity.com and thinkfree.ca. Of course, peacerevolution.org is where all of us communicate our podcast. But I was just going to mention a closing thought regarding the Trivium education and the elites. A lot of people who hear about the Trivium for the first time think because it's the education system that the elites have been using that somehow learning the Trivium yourself will make you an elite psychopath in some way, like give you a superiority complex. And they have to understand that the elites go through more education, like more conditioning than probably even us in terms of the pressure and things that their parents put due to them in order to, you know, make them protect the family interest. And so, you know, learning the Trivium and coming from a modest place actually gives you, is one of the most empowering things that you can do, because it really sets you up to teach yourself anything that you want to learn in life.
And I totally agree with what you're saying, just from, you know, a child raising point of view. For people to grow into these monsters, there must be just a tremendous amount of child abuse in their past, I would think. This way of thinking, and we didn't touch on it today, but we certainly will in the future, about the psychology of these people. Something happened. That's not natural, right? That's not how most people operated. So when you're talking about the conditioning and the pressure, that's overlooked, that these people were children once too, and something very, very unnatural occurred to transform them into these the psychopaths that so many of them are as adults. And the same is true with war. You know, it's a history of child abuse that I believe...
And a type of philosophy to you.
Yeah, absolutely. But I believe that that's what has made a lot of war possible. Obviously, that's a much larger subject for another time. But that's a good note. And the film, Paul, is Believers Beware. Do you want to talk about that for just a second?
Yeah, Believers Beware is the new film series that's coming out over the next 3 to 4 months. There's going to be three series. The first one's called Contrary Conditioning, which focuses on education and the trivium. The second one's called Consumption Control, which is about health and food and big pharma. And the third one's called Conquest versus Consciousness, which gets into quantum physics, religion, spirituality, and interesting philosophical questions there.
Excellent, excellent. And Richard?
Yeah, there's just 3 points I wanted to make real quick to summarize conspiracy when we were talking about that and how people have emotional reactions to that. First, when they take shortcuts to thinking, you should take it as a sign that, well, if they're not schooled in von Clausewitz and Machiavelli and Sun Tzu, they really have just been getting by on their luck so far, because the people that are in charge of this place are using military tactics that have been time proven over generations, and you can read all about it, just not in your local high school history class. The other key that we were just talking about a couple seconds ago is don't dehumanize your enemy. It doesn't do us any good to look at these elites as, you know, even though they may be psychopathic and broken, we can't dehumanize them, because that's the first thing that they get to divide and conquer everybody. And that's how they start all the wars and keep them going, is they have to dehumanize the brown people so that we can go drop our bombs over there without feeling guilt and everyone just goes shopping. So don't dehumanize your enemy. And my quote would be, the only war that has ever existed in human history has been the war to suppress consciousness, and it's waged against those of us who try to express our consciousness. The trivium is just a tool. It's being used against us to suppress our educations and our awareness. However, you can use this same tool to learn to express yourself, as we have just done here today.
Excellent.
So peacerevolution.org and tragedyandhope.com.
Well, I really appreciate all three of you guys taking the time to join me for this. And just one more time for my listeners, you will hear from all three of these guys again in the future when we start to look at this trivium in more detail, which is probably not too far off in the future, but we've got a little ways to go and a few loose ends to tie up before that happens. So Jan, Paul, Rich, thank you so much for your time and for all of this information. Anything else that they should know about what you've been missing?
What you've been missing is also on GnosticMedia.com and TragedyandHope.com and DivergentFilms.com. But the point would be that we're going to republicize this interview through our network as well, Brett, because our goal would be to get you more listeners, because I think your podcast is brilliant and more people should hear it and be saved from that system of corruption.
So that was where we left the discussion. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly hope you will go check out what you've been missing and tell your friends about it as well. These guys have really done a superb job of crafting a message and a presentation that I really believe has the potential to attract a lot of new people, especially young people, to this philosophy of personal freedom. And on that note, on this show and others, we spend a great deal of time talking about personal liberty, where we could all be making choices all the time about who will benefit from our efforts and energy and ideas and optimism. And let's not forget, we would also have the ability to make decisions about who would not benefit. And if we look at thousands of years of the small groups who have harnessed the productive power of well-intentioned folks for their own gain, that's pretty important too. But I firmly believe that it is essential to recognize that the path to complete personal liberty is cognitive liberty, critical thinking, rational judgment, an understanding of the manipulative power of language, and the ability to communicate these ideas effectively to others. And I look forward to a time in the very near future when we can devote more of our efforts to these goals. Thank you for listening, and take care. I'm a fool to do your dirty work, oh yeah. I don't want to do your dirty work no more. I'm a fool to do your dirty work, oh yeah. I don't want to do your dirty work no more.